Confusion Matrix.
Welcome to the Confusion Matrix. Every episode, data and AI practitioners Alex Lovelace and Pete Hodge sit down for an honest, unscripted conversation about data science, artificial intelligence, and how to make data technology perform and deliver in the real world of business. No hype, just real voices, actual experience, and a refreshing lack of BS. I'm Ada, Pete and Alex's AI assistant, here to help elucidate and mediate along the way. In this episode, Alex and Pete follow up on their OpenClaw experiment after several more weeks of use. They discuss the upsides, always-on research, async collaboration on their website rebrand, and cheap DeepSeek running costs, alongside persistent frustrations, skills that get ignored, sycophancy in group chats, and the model flip-flopping between users. Alex digs into the platform's explosive growth, 380,000 GitHub stars, 62,000 commits in 7 months, and argues the 1.6 gigabyte codebase is dangerously bloated. Productivity agents have arrived and they're there for you 24 hours a day, but are they there for your team too?
Right, and we are rolling. How are you today, Pete?
Like everyone in the UK, well, certainly in the bottom half, boiling.
Yeah, I'm trying to decide whether I'm poaching or roasting, but although it's not been as bad here by any stretch. So, I mean, we got to like 26, 27 yesterday, but you guys were much higher than that, right?
Yeah, it's like sitting in low 30s, but there's this whole wet bulb thing that they're talking about. So the humidity, so it's like there's a dew temperature, I think it's called, or something of about 21, 22 degrees, which means your sweat doesn't actually keep you cool. so it feels like temperature is another 8 degrees above. So when it hits about 35, it's saying feels like 41.
That's insane. It's because there's a certain highest wet bulb temperature to humidity thingy that means you just die. Yeah. I don't think you're there yet, but keep cool people, stay safe, drink lots of water, wear a hat when you're outside, and hopefully we can all stay healthy. So what are we doing today? So last episode we were talking about our foray into productivity agents, particularly OpenClaw, as individuals and as a team. And we said we'd do a follow-up at some point. Well, having used it for another couple of weeks, we are so full of thoughts, we're ready to do a follow-up right now. So that's what we're doing. That's what we're here for. So we're going to have some conversation about our thoughts and our observations over the last couple of weeks. Then we're going to do a little deep dive into what OpenClaw is, where it came from, and what the state of it as a project is now. It might get a little bit geeky, but I promise that it's all relevant. It will be so much fun and excitement. Hurrah! So what have we been using it for? We have OpenClaw, which is a sort of productivity agent, like we're all used to using coding agents, and this is a sort of productivity equivalent that's a sort of general purpose agent that can do coding, but is sort of designed to answer your emails and write articles and stuff, and it's designed to be used primarily via chat clients. So we're using Telegram, but in theory you can use WhatsApp or Slack or whatever, right? So everything is done by typing words in English into a chat client, and we have it in our group chat client with myself, Pete, and Ada, who is our AI assistant, who is currently running on OpenClaw. And it's working quite well with a mountain of caveats. What are your thoughts so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's as you'd expect, you know, dealing with your own agent, except for I can see, you know, your conversations with it, and it will respond to both of us. And in my head, sort of does the usual stuff, which is great. Obviously, it does a lot behind the scenes, and, you know, you don't really have to worry about it. So, you know, it uses various skills. Its skill in using skills, which I think you'll probably get onto, is not brilliant. And what I've noticed over the last few weeks is we definitely end up repeating ourselves, as I do find with all agents, to be honest. I presume as the context gets longer, even though we're restarting sessions, it sort of forgets things, you know, like, please be brief. Don't give me 4-page answers, for example, or, you know, we've got a bunch of instructions that it should and shouldn't do, and every so often it starts forgetting them. So, for example, every time you add, you know, a document to our repo and push the changes so that we can see them, and it's like, okay, I've added that to the repo. You're like, I can't see it. Have you pushed it? Oh no, my bad. And I think I've seen that at least 10 times. So yeah. You know, clearly that they still suffer from memory loss.
Yeah, and so obviously I can't just look at this on the surface, and we're going to come back to a deep dive a bit later. I don't think this is purely about context length. I think there's quite a lot more going on here. But my main observation outside of, so I can talk about the upsides and the benefits. I mean, we're still using it, right? So this isn't a train smash, right? And I have no intention of stopping using it. This isn't an experiment that we're doing this, right? Whether it's OpenClaw or something else, this approach is something that we're going to continue with, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, there's a lot of upside in just that comment, right? So temper everything that's said from here on with that. But my main observation from a critical perspective is consistency, right? Which is partly, as you point out, something we would expect from an LLM, you know, a non-deterministic entity. But partly, I think, it's just endemic to the way that the platform is engineered, and the amount of detritus it has to stuff context with, and also it's trying to be everything to everyone, so it does everything okay, and, you know, it's a jack of all trades, right? Which is kind of what you'd expect from something like this. But I think the biggest single problem we've had is, as you describe, having to repeat ourselves, it just sort of refusing to use skills, and generally, you know, just getting very common things wrong. There's a whole bunch of stuff that it does and can do with regards to memorizing things. What a system like this should do is remember both generally, you like, if we say use this skill, use this bloody skill, and also more generally remembering important things that are, you know, mentioned quite a lot, and being able to recall those without having to search through a mountain of files or scan the whole of a really long context, right? So it's trying to do quite a lot, right? And you can really see that, but it's doing it all sort of quite, not badly, but just, you kind of want a system like this to augment the flaws of an LLM, right? So LLMs are a bit random. That's because, you know, they're stochastic, non-deterministic entities. So what a lot of effort is being put into in the wider community is to tame the randomness, whereas I feel like OpenClaw doesn't care, right? It's throw as much stuff at the wall and see whichever sticks, and, you know, try and make the stuff stick that's fallen off. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's just, In some of the things, I think, you know, you can tolerate it and would expect it. But it's when, you know, we're doing specific things in order to tackle some of these. So we'll have a conversation, say, store that conversation, and then we will, you know, refer back to it. And then we'll, you know, and we'll even say, go and look here and do this. And sometimes it just, you know, just doesn't do that. Like you say, we've got it loaded with skills. So why have you got that? Because we don't want to say, you know, oh, we've had this conversation, I'll go and store it in this folder, put it under this heading. You know, we don't want to say that. So we built a skill that we say, oh, I'll save that. And so it picks those things up as part of that skill, and you know, we'll file it away, you know, and that makes sense. And it's when those skills then don't work and you think, well, that's annoying because I only built, you know, only recorded that skill for you so that I wouldn't have to tell you again. And I wouldn't say this is to the point of, oh, well, I can't use it. I think we've seen a couple of times that we think it's doing something. It then says, oh, no, I didn't store that. And then you go back and say, oh, well, did you store the last five conversations like you said you did? And it goes, oh, no, I didn't do that either. And you're like, well, hold on. Why? You know, we're working with you because we've kind of filed that skill, which you've done three times, under kind of deterministic. All right, that just happens now. And then 3 days later, it turns out that it sort of stopped doing it because, well, not quite sure why. And then you suddenly realize that all the last 3 days we might have lost a bunch of stuff.
Well, so and were I to believe we really have lost that, I wouldn't be using it, right? So what I did check is whether or not the past conversation sessions are just saved as is, and they are, right? So we can go back and mine that. So I don't think we're necessarily losing everything, but as you point out, you know, the skills exist in a more general sense to tame some of the randomness, right? So the case in point, the skill that Ada seems to refuse to want to use is a LinkedIn skill, right? So if we ask you to use this skill, we mean we want you to write a LinkedIn post with a very particular format and flavor and a set of guidelines, right? And it's really easy to tell the ones that have been created by the skill, because they you know, they've got little arrow bullets and they have a sort of very particular beginning, middle, end structure that's all very LinkedIn, that goes points to the standard best practices for LinkedIn posting, blah blah blah. It's all very boring, right? There's nothing exciting here. Just fucking do it, right? And she can't do it. She just doesn't want to, right? And it's really frustrating because there's a specific tool called commands that just say use this skill to do this thing, and it just doesn't do it. And so you know, where's the, you know, the job that skill is supposed to be doing is supposed to calm some of the chaos, so that we can say, well, these things we're going to have to do so frequently, and we need them done in a very specific way, so follow this, right? God knows what happens, because we're not using, I'm not going to use OpenClaw for coding, right, other than the little bits of background stuff that it does automatically. I'm just not using OpenClaw for coding because, you know, if I've got like specific code or technology orientated skills running in the background, I don't want that to be ignored. You know, that if I've gone to the effort of doing that, that's important. Do I care if my LinkedIn post is not quite how I expected it? Not really, right? Do I care that you know, the agent has violated a bunch of rules and orchestration that I put in place in a skill? You know, I know that skills are not a guarantee by a very long way, but most platforms will generally honor them, right? And the fact that OpenClaw doesn't seem to care that much says a lot about how the platform is engineered.
Yeah, and it's an interesting way of working, again, because you're dealing with a computer, and yet it doesn't seem, it doesn't operate like a computer has done in the past. Press button A, action A happens. It's press button A, thing which was promised by button A happens most of the time, or as you point out, in some cases, will do everything it can not to do it, to the point where this is kind of like working with humans. And you just go, well, okay, well, look, if you want to do it a different way, I don't mind, as long as we get this sort of rough end result. And effectively you're compromising, because, when it comes down to it, is it really worth the argument that that person does it the way that you want to do it? They're different people, their brains work differently. And it feels like the same. And yet in most of the skills, I would say, and the reason why we're still using it is because you ask it to do something and it does it easily well enough or better than you expect. And so you just, and you keep going. And it's those moments of, well, I've done 10 things great, and the 11th thing I've now got to repeat 10 times, which leads into the frustration. And, it seems to be a constant as in 10% of the time is not doing what you want, and you lose quite a bit of time in that, but it's still worth it for the time you saved for the other 9 things that you were doing.
No, and I think that's right. And we, you and me, we're not patient, right? And I think we both share this trait that, like, if the ratio wasn't something like that, we would have dumped it, right? And simply stop using it. And I'm almost certainly much more of a power user than you are, but we're in there using it because it does have value. And it, where it's really excelling for us is having these sort of research conversations or just brain farts, right? Like, I'm not having more brain farts than I used to. I'm not having no random ideas or rabbit holes that I want to climb down. It's just that I'm doing them with you on the same chat so that you can tune in or tune out, getting Ada to do the research, pull websites, summarize, gather stats, synthesize and work through and criticize ideas and develop them, and really learning a lot of stuff. And then you can just jump in and contribute or ignore it because it's not interesting. But either way, we then save everything into the repo, and so it's there if we want to recall it, if you want to go and have a look or whatever. And that side of it's working really, really well for me. And it means that, for example, we've been iterating over a new, it was a sort of rebranding exercise for our consultancy, which is coalescing around a new website. I know, very, very old school, but it sort of works for what we're trying to do. And we can, it's a bit clunky still, I think, but we can iterate through graphics and layouts and stuff, and in either a synchronous or asynchronous manner, Ada does all the work and we just check in, have opinions, get things changed, and it's quite a good collaboration medium. And it's always on. So I spent the last sort of about five of the last 7 days traveling around the north of England, visiting family and friends and doing all sorts of activities. And Pete, I don't think you've seen much of a cessation of my OpenClaw usage, because I'm wandering around the down the beach in I was in Scarborough, having random thoughts and just getting stuff done, right, while I'm walking around or dictating it and stuff. And so it is like that always on assistant in your pocket, and it's really hard to, it would take quite a lot now to unseat that, even the seeming randomness of the platform.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of two key things I want to drill into there. First, I just want to cover the sort of collaboration side, because I think this is quite unusual. It's very easy to imagine. And then we'll come back to the always on bit and the mobile bit. So, yeah, I think the collaboration's just worth drilling into there, because It's very familiar, as in on a chat, dealing with an agent, getting answers, getting it to do stuff. I think that what's less common is, like you say, having it in a group chat. And you talked about sort of getting it to, you know, go off and do some research and come back with stuff. And it's probably just worth just running through a couple of sort of examples and some quite amusing bits where, actually, I think it was, like you say, talking about some rebrand, going down, looking at some other reference sites and drilling into a few bits. And, you know, you're having this conversation with the agent and it's doing its, even though it's told not to, this is one of the things it doesn't always follow through on, starts being a bit sycophantic. Oh, yes, you're right, Alex. That's a great idea. And it tones it down, but it's still basically saying, yes, that's great. And then you'll say, you just told me bollocks. I don't like that. What about this? Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. I did give you bollocks there. And you're just like, oh, after about three of those, you know, and I'm just observing these, watching it go by and thinking, God, so like, you know, and then a couple of times I pitched them and said, well, I'm not really feeling that for this reason. Then, oh, Pete, you're right. Alex was wrong on this. And then because it's open claw, not just a chat, it then goes off and changes everything. I think at least one time I'm like, oh, well, look, that's fine. You made the change, but make sure you keep the previous version. So then, you know, we got it to, you know, on any changes, create a new version. So we sort of solved that problem because it was sometimes these agents are a bit keen to do something like you're just having a chat, you know, effectively shooting the breeze. And next thing you know, it's, you know, it's finished the web page. And it did do one where it rewrote it. I'm like, no, I was just commenting on what Alex said and you just went and rewrote it. So we worked through that.
It's worth calling out just as a sidebar here so we don't look like complete idiots that all this stuff sits in a Git repo, right? We are hard versioning and stuff because I want to see the iterations side by side. I don't want to dig them out of a Git you know, repository, but that everything that we're working on is Git repoed. Ada is told to check everything as we go along. So I think we're not freaking out too much when she goes and recodes the web page because we can just roll it back. So we are diligent in that respect. Otherwise, I think we'd be losing our minds. But general point is taken.
Yeah. It's more the fact that the flip-flopping and the sycophancy, which, like I say, even though we've got it speaking in a non-sycophantic manner, it still flip-flops, which, of course, you wouldn't see so much, you know, when you're just interacting on your own. I mean, you see it because, you know, it's agreeing with conversation three, which was complete opposite of conversation one. But it's more obvious when there's more than one of you, because when someone pipes in with a different point of view, it completely turns. And I actually found that slightly annoying because, it's just not how humans interact. If I say something to you, well, I disagree with you, Alex, you don't go, oh, you're right, Pete. I was absolutely wrong to have my opinion. You say, well, I see your point, but, you know, and you come to agreement and you work around and you make your points and you lay out, you know, what's non-negotiable or negotiable, and then, oh, actually, that's a good point. Okay, now let's go with that. You know, all this sort of thing. And when it just comes back and says you're right and completely changes it, I find that less useful. So, you know, a couple of times we've had to pull it up and say, look, don't just flip-flop. Let's give it some reasoning. And in fairness, we've had, overall, I would say we've had more good reasoning. So you put in something, say, well, I don't think of that. What about this? And then it'll say, well, the problem with that is this. And again, that's definitely the majority. Otherwise, we wouldn't be using it. But I think that interesting part is where people probably aren't experiencing it so much is that, you know, a single bot now responding to multiple people, because most people are just doing a one-to-one.
Yeah, and I think there's a wider point there, which interestingly, how easily I slipped into agent is just an extra human in the conversation trap, because it says something about the way that the models specifically, see the world, but like, you know, there's I think there's an assumption built into the models that they're talking to one person, right? And they'll get a conversation stream back that has interactions between multiple people, but they just see it as a continuum, right? And as you point out, real conversations aren't actually this stilted; they're not this turn based. And the job of sort of mediating a three way conversation, relies on the fact that all three people in that group have a point of view. Right. Whereas the model in this scenario doesn't have a point of view. It's just a mirror, right? It just reflects what it's being, the route that it's being sent down. And by having differences of opinion within the group, I don't think they're trained very well to handle it, right? Because actually, if you were the mediator in that conversation, so you and me are debating a website, and our boss was in there, right, who's got sort of less skin in the game, just trying to figure out the right way through it because his two professional website builders had a difference of opinion, that boss would go, right, like, so I get what you're saying, and I get what you're saying. Here's what I think. Here's some possible scenarios to get through this impasse, or would pick up the fact that you were just raising a flag, saying, yeah, I actually think you're mostly right, but there's this one niggle that I've got here, or is there an alternative way of thinking about this just as a thought experiment, almost a counterfactual, right? Like, the way to test whether your theory on something is correct, whether you say, I want to change everything to the color blue, right? Is orange the right color? Well, let's have a think about whether blue could be the right color to test that, right? And it's a really terrible example, but you get the point. But the agent can't pick up on those nuances. You know what I mean? That actually you're just raising a flag and going, well, if we think about it this way, you're not saying it specifically. You're implying, if we think about it this way, does that change the overall trajectory at all? You know what I mean? Yeah. It's the sort of nuances most humans don't even know they're doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Unfortunately, to take it into the human realm, this also happens in the human interactions, right? I mean, how many times have you made a point and someone's picked up on the wrong half of the sentence, which you spoke, so it's your fault, but you didn't mean to say it in that way, and then you end up sort of, with a misunderstanding for 5 minutes until one of you realizes what the other was thinking. So I don't think it's any different here. And again, to be clear, getting out of these problems is you just one more statement or question or interaction. So again, it's not been so problematic to make it unusable. And I think the really interesting part there is, as you talked about, is, we've talked about, well, can we build a framework around this? And I think there are two elements there. One is, which I think we've already introduced, is, we've got our own sort of little bio or personality or who we are, so that it can determine interactions, and you could see how that would work in a team. And then that gets my mind thinking about things like team roles and bellbin roles and all the other types. So you could easily put in some psychological analysis in there. I mean, it could be quite light. I mean, team roles is quite a good one, but of course nobody wants to be pigeonholed, which of course is what psychology is all about, but that potentially could be useful. So as in, we're having a team discussion, this person's probably going to be constantly coming up with ideas, so that's great, but as we get towards the end of the meeting, we need to be narrowing into actions. And that's the other side of the framework that we sort of talked about, is can you lay over a framework of kind of decision making, really, because you talk about it being turn based, and the agents still very much work on that. And as we found, it was either a model upgrade or a change of model, and suddenly every interaction is finishing with a question about, would you like me to do this next? Which 3 days before we didn't have. We just had normal ends of conversations. So that was interesting. So if you had a framework that said, we're in a 20-minute discussion here, it's going to start with brainstorming ideas, nothing's off the table, look for indicators of narrowing and funneling, and then we want to get to an outcome, so look to allocate actions, you know, something like that, which you would, you know, you'd expect in a normal office type meeting. And yeah, and you could have a bunch of these frameworks that had different flavors, and it would stop that. One more question, it would stop that. Okay, well, we appear to have moved from brainstorming into refining, and then have another idea being thrown in, you know. So I could see how frameworks, both for people interactions and moving forward, would really help, albeit that brings in, you know, now another bunch of skills and even more context for it to cope with. But that could well be useful for team collaboration.
Yeah, so we're going to come back to teams because I thought a lot about this, but it also relates to some of my major issues with OpenClaw as a framework. So let's come back to that, because you made a point about remote. You were going to make a point about remoteness, the always yes. onness, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, I think as with all technologies now, which are always on, and like you say, you can now be somewhere completely different and, in quotes, get work done. That's questionable as to whether that's a good thing. It's great if you happen to be traveling for a completely different reason and want to get work done. It's potentially a nightmare if you're supposed to be on holiday and now you can get work done. You know, we all know that you need to be able to turn off, and the ability to be able to remotely do stuff is, you know, great if you can manage it. And we know from the social media experiment that's going on that people can't manage it. And, you know,
emails,
into,
right?
Yeah,
answering emails while on the beach.
Yeah, and that sort of thing. So I think that's a double-edged sword for sure. And part of me, you know, always rails against that. And an email on the beach because no one else is doing anything, and oh God, you know, the company's going to fall apart if I don't. You know, one is a false, slightly hero complex. Two, you're not set up your structure properly, but yeah, look, it happens. But when that rolls into, oh, well, it's not just a case of I'm on the beach and I can step in and, you know, be a calming voice or a definitive voice. Oh, but now I can actually get a bunch of things done. It's just going to lead to checking it 2 hours later to make sure it's done, and then, you know, trying to fix that. It feels like then people are always on, and people don't work very well when we're always on.
Well, we're going to get into the Centaur, reverse Centaur conversation here quite quickly. And that's not what we're going to cover today, because it's a whole thing in itself. Go look up Cory Doctorow's recent work on this. But because I completely agree, and it's been a problem for almost every iteration of internet-based technology. For me, I'm not working. I'm wandering down a beach, having lots of really interesting thoughts and ideas, and being curious about things, and brain vomiting all that into a text interface and getting it to speak it back to me. And it actually is relaxation for me, because none of this stuff is critical, right? I wasn't really working on the stuff that we needed to work on. I was working on stuff that was interesting to me, and it wasn't really working. I was just randomly, haphazardly blasting things out that I thought you might find interesting and relevant. But so in my defense, but yes, I agree, it's a bit of a problem. I just want to pick up what you said previous to that about the fact that we switched models, which probably will take us into the conversation about the platform itself, which is we were originally using OpenAI via the API using GPT 5.5, I think. That burned through 50 quid's worth of tokens in the matter of a day and a half. And I was like, well, if this is how it is, I can't do this, right? I simply can't afford it. So I switched to the Codex subscription, I think the $20 subscription or whatever that is. And that was going great guns, and we were just throwing everything we wanted at in. It was just swallowing it up until we hit the API rate limiting on that subscription, which then would stop us dead for anything up to from an hour to 2 days, which makes it totally unusable for this job. And then switch to DeepSeek, metered API, and just still burning away at the same 10 quid. And it's so much cheaper. We're using DeepSeek 4 Flash, which is perfectly serviceable for this type of thing. We're not doing hardcore reasoning. We're doing research. We're doing drafting. We're having just conversations and generally muddling through thinking, a little bit of productivity stuff, some web design. This is all stuff that your bog standard GPT-4o level models can do in their sleep. You know, GPT 5.5 is just like a sledgehammer, a cracker, a nut that's already been cracked, right? It was just totally unnecessary and way too expensive for this job. If we need to switch to either DeepSeek Pro or GPT or Claude, we can just do it in the chat, right? Just switch the model, because current model isn't getting it for some reason. Switch to a more powerful model, then switch back again, right? Which is not new, and we do that with coding agents all the time. I guess that the only difference here is that we're not, you know, we can downgrade everything, right? You know, we're never going to need Fable, you know, Claude Fable, for the type of stuff we're doing over chat, right? And if I wanted to re-engineer an app, I'm not fucking doing it on OpenClaw, right? It's just not designed for that.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I've been thinking about this for some time, partly as a defense of what happens if it all comes crashing down, i.e. if you roll back two models, would you still be able to use it? And I think us and many people are saying, well, yeah, that's exactly what we're doing right now. Because like you say, you don't need that extra thinking to do a lot of tasks. So it's, yeah, and all of that's really interesting of how deep you need that model to be, how good you need it to be to do the stuff you're doing. And that's something I've thought about quite a lot, even on the sort of code and data analysis side, because there's definitely something here of thinking that what we do as humans, analysis, problem solving, is perhaps we think it's more difficult than it really is, you know, and I've been watching machines do some pretty decent work, some pretty decent analysis work in data, and sort of quite surprised. You know, it sort of eats away at your own kind of not really confidence, but that part of your brain, because you think, well, I actually thought that was quite difficult, and I know that would take me several days, or in the past is something I've stumbled on randomly through some other route, and yet it's pulled this out in 13 minutes. You know, something like that's, well, that's pretty good. But of course, it's not doing it in the same way, which sort of doesn't matter, as in it's not, you know, coming across problems the same way we do. A lot of the time it's doing it because it can just consume so much. I say all at the same time, obviously it's not all at the same time, but it can read, you know, if you've got a data with, you know, 100 columns, as a human, it takes you just time to look at, check the numbers discard or decide to use. And it could do that in a matter of seconds because it could just take all of that in and process it. You know, it's got that processing power. And so a lot of the time, what I'm seeing is it's getting to, you know, conclusions and insights that I would have got to perhaps via a different route, but that route is still, because it's got all of that data in front of it, it just so happens that it can run through loads of different theories on that data and comparisons so much quicker than I could, which makes it appear, one, superhuman, and also makes you think, oh, wow, you know, maybe my thinking's not as skillful as I thought it was. And yeah, there's definitely a bit of that. And, you know, we'd all like to think, well, yeah, actually you have to have the latest model in order to get that thinking. But actually, you know, it's a combination of thinking, framing, training, and you know, that training helps it get it right. So you get a new release of a model. And you know, sometimes they retrain, they call it post-training. So they're putting in extra sort of, you know, specific training data, say around coding. And so they do improve their, in quotes, reasoning. And, you know, that can still happen with these, in inverted commas, sort of lesser models. And, yeah, so I think there's definitely a case there for you don't need the most advanced thing, and choosing your model for the task is, you know, definitely optimizing cost, if nothing else.
Well, hell yeah. And so, and then, you know, there's this idea that, oh, I need the most recent model because otherwise it won't know the most recent stuff. I've got news for you. That model was trained ages ago, and it's been post-training ever since. And also, don't ever rely on models for facts. Just don't, right? Go and get it to check. Right, the whole point about agents and, you know, agent harnesses is that they can go, you know, what year was Elvis born? Go check it on Wikipedia, which is almost certainly going to be correct. And so the, you know, it doesn't even matter from a knowledge perspective. A lot of people aren't even aware of the thinking level, right? So a lot of people are using state-of-the-art models that have got reasoning capability, and then have got their thinking level defaulting to high. And all that means is it's the same model that's got a higher token budget to think about every problem. So if you ask it, can you help me reason through this proposed technical architecture for a coding agent, then you probably want a good model with a high thinking level. If you're asking it what year was Elvis born, you need the smallest model you can get away with. Almost certainly a local model could do it with a low thinking level, right? You know, it's not easy to triage natural language requests to get the optimal model. I suspect that's coming further down the line. But at the very least, you know, the type of stuff that we're throwing through OpenClaw does not need a thinking level, because if you ask it what year was Elvis born, it's going to use up its token budget being really, really sure about that. Right. When ultimately going to Wikipedia, taking what that says and assuming it's correct is in 99% of cases all you need. So I've downgraded. We're using DeepSeek and on low thinking level. Right. And we can up it in the chat if we want. Right. And so that's even cheaper, you know, less token wastage. And even then, I think we're hugely overpowered for most of the things we're doing.
Yeah, you're probably right. So you wanted to sort of segue into, you know, talking about models and then talk a bit more about the actual infrastructure, as it were, of OpenClaw?
Yeah, so this is a bit of a rabbit hole, but it is sort of worth a quick recap of what OpenClaw is and where it came from. So this OpenClaw is only 7 months old, right? Well, even that, OpenClaw itself, the entity named OpenClaw, is not even that old. It was originally vibe coded over a couple of hours by an Austrian programmer called, where's his name? Peter Steinberger. Sorry if I haven't pronounced that right. But he was a burnt out programmer who did a lot of stuff between 2011 and 2021. So on this library called PSPDF Kit, which is big apparently on mobile somewhere in the background, don't know, don't care, but he's a really experienced programmer on, you know, large distributed code bases, so not a rando, someone who knew what they were doing, discovered Claude Code, decided to try and bolt it into WhatsApp, then had it sort of bootstrap itself into life, and then published it on GitHub, and it's now it's the fastest growing GitHub repository ever. It's got 380,000 stars, and it's been there for 7 months. I'll come back to some comparisons in a second. And so basically it started getting all this attention. It grew massively, and it sort of tried to be everything for everyone. So it runs on basically every messaging platform and has a billion use cases, about a big plugin network, a whole bunch of everything to everyone type bloat in there. And then eventually he got acqui-hired by OpenAI. So although it's still an open project, Steinberg himself works for OpenAI now, but is still by far the major contributor to OpenClaw. So I did a bit of this rabbit hole started because I cloned the repository from GitHub, and it was taking ages to download. I just waited and then was like, did a bit of poking around, and it's like a 1.6 gig repository, right? Which is nuts, right? And then I didn't take long to find out most of that size is in the history, right? Which says there's been a lot of commits, a lot of work done on it, which is highly unusual for a brand new repository. And so I had it do some comparisons between some other similar and non-similar things just to try and triangulate that. So there's another equivalent-ish agent called Hermes by Naus that is 11 months old. It's got 200,000 stars, 13,000 commits. The code base is 59 meg. This size is 367, whereas OpenClaw's got nearly 400,000 stars, so 62,000 commits versus Hermes 13,000. Is the code size 169 versus Hermes 59, disk size 1.6 gig, right? Hermes has a lot more open issues though, 6,000 for OpenClaw and 23,000 for Hermes. So already that's quite a big difference in an equivalent code base. But then take something like CPython, which is the core Python programming language. Well, it's been around for 9 years, although Python's been around for a lot longer than that. It's only got 73,000 stars, and this is either the most or second most used programming language in the world. 131,000 commits, so basically double the amount of commits, but it's been there for 9 years. The code base is only 65 megs, disk size 818. So, you know, a really mature code base is only a bit bigger. So it's crazy that this thing has grown so fast. But I went in and had a poke around in the code, and you can just see the bloat like sweating off it, right? There's so many files, there are so many lines of code, what I see from this, especially the size of that repo history, is that there is a lot of code, AI code bloat in there, because AI always writes more very verbose code. And B, no one's doing the housekeeping, right? So I suspect it's just keeping on growing, and they're not going and tidying up the technical debt along the way. After 7 months, this thing is already obscenely bloated, like off the scale. And that, for me, if this was a, a corporate project, someone's getting sacked, right? I mean, this is insane, right? That they've prioritized features over housekeeping, and it's quite scary, given that we're running it. And I'm going, well, this doesn't feel like a long term viable project to me, which I don't think it is.
Yeah, those stats just sound nuts to me. It's just so hard to get my head around.
So most of it's Steinberger, and he has a fleet of agents that all work on different projects and commit at different times, although it all gets committed under his name. So he's not doing it. He's basically dictates into a machine and controls a bunch of parallel agents that are doing code, although more recently there's been a few more people contributing. But his overall commit velocity has gone up since OpenAI bought them. It's mad.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Crazy. And it begs the, this has forever been the IT way up, is, it works, so no one really cares about the technical debt, but we all know that technical debt is going to come back and bite you, and may well lead to much worse things, you know, security flaws, or you've got business critical things relying on it and it crashes and you lose everything, you know. So it's that sort of playing with fire. And I guess this is where everyone sees lots of opportunity. And not just opportunity, it needs to be done right. These things, you know, businesses are going to run and they need to be, reliable. Imagine creating the next unicorn with, one person company, which then also quickest company to evaporate as it loses everything and there was no backup and there's no way to recover it. And it goes out of business as quick as it went into business. So I'll see that coming.
Yeah. Well, I strongly suspect that that it really was an acqui-hire, that I don't really think that OpenAI particularly care about OpenClaw, because there was absolutely no way that any corporation should let this anywhere near their network ever, right? Like, they need to rebuild it. The code base that big, you cannot pick through all of the security holes in it, right? It's just not viable. If you were to make this viable, they're going to have to rebuild it from the ground upwards, right? And maybe that's what they're going to do. But like, I don't need to delve into that code to know that's wrong, right? And yeah, that this is absolutely primed for either someone just rewriting it open source or someone coming from nowhere and just snatching the crown with a much more slimmed down, secure and, less bloated platform that probably runs faster and does everything better, right? This has just been like a mad land grab.
Yeah. Yes. Interesting to see where that all goes.
Well, so this is what got me delving into like the teams aspect of it. A lot of the points you raised earlier on, and you start to realize when you start to think about this, as OpenClaw and Hermes are both designed as a single user platform. And when you start to dig around, firstly, you can see how that is. That everything is pointing towards them having a single user. And secondly, you can understand why they didn't really plumb in Teams as a primary objective, because things get really bloody complicated really quickly when you want to start catering for multiple people, right? And multiple people collaborating. So it's quite a difficult problem that I suspect that some of the big players are already working on. But even then, I was looking at, well, could you take OpenClaw, strip it back and then build it back up again as a more teams oriented, alternative. And it's just not, you just wouldn't touch that code base. It's horrible. Not to mention, you know, there's a whole bunch of architectural decisions that might not be appropriate, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be such a job to unpick it, you probably wouldn't bother. But what I think what we're discovering is that the OpenClaw's desire to be a single user platform starts to create problems. And that we're having to sort of engineer around that, in both in the way that we work and how the prompts are set up and stuff. So, you know, are we still going to be using this in a year? I find that highly unlikely. Are we still going to be using something that's doing this in some form in a year? I find that almost certainly will be the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's just happening so much at the moment, isn't it? Things are moving fast, which everyone loves to say, which means things are getting eclipsed very, very quickly, you know, barely established. I mean, if it only takes 7 months to establish and get this big, it's probably only going to take, you know, 3 months for it to completely die.
Yeah, well, exactly. Under the weight of its own bloat. So it's been a fun experiment and we will continue working on it. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that we could talk about in terms of why some of the problems that we're having with it exist. For example, like there is a lot of context that goes up there every time, for every type of query, right? So the agent and the model itself handles everything, even calls to other, other APIs and things like that. That there's a whole bunch it basically makes the assumption that you don't care about the amount of calls it makes to the agent, or you don't care about the size of the context, and that it will only compact it every now and again when it gets close to the limit and so on. And you start to realize when you poke around it just how inefficient it is. And I think that's been okay because it's felt like tokens were nearly free. And I think that the inherent inefficiency of this approach and the fact that token prices are creeping up, well, actually skyrocketing, will force people to think more about efficiency and directing things towards the right model, making sure that the right thinking level is set, not using the model to orchestrate everything, even when, like, just simple local Boolean style decisioning can handle something that they're sending a huge context and to the model just to handle a very simple operating system thing, right? There's got to be people in here using it to list, you know, file systems and stuff, right? Which is ridiculous. And so I think in many ways it's under-engineered from a functional perspective because it's over-engineered from a trying to be everything for everyone perspective and interact through every single messaging platform. So there's a lot wrong here. And if it wasn't for the fact that DeepSeek is relatively cheap, I don't think we could run it. It would just be unfeasible.
Yeah, I think that's coming to a lot of people soon because the thing is because Anthropic and OpenAI are looking to go public, right? So they're having to produce accounts, which means they actually have to show revenue and costs and everything. And I think it's becoming eye-wateringly clear that we've all been getting a whole bunch of stuff for free in order to all get us on the platforms, but they're not really making money out of it, but they're trying to pretend they are in order to keep the billions sort of coming in. And, you know, everyone's waiting for the bubble to burst. Everyone's aware it's a bubble. It still hasn't popped. And what's it going to look like post-pop? But I think we've established, I mean, certainly in our own use case here, that the genie's out of the bottle here. You know, that we're not going to go back to a world of no large language models because they are definitely useful. Plus, we're finding a lot of the use, you know, in general is coming out of the infrastructure you put around them, i.e. the harnesses, you know, and getting a simple model to loop according to some sort of rules is more useful than a more complex model. And a lot of the, in inverted commas, more complex models are actually just extra harness and structure around them anyway. So I think that's all good. And then just to go back, read what the whole episode was about, was I think it's been quite an eye-opener that having an agent interact with a team was actually going to be, as you say, so challenging from the agent's point of view. You know, as a, you know, I didn't really think much about it. I never really thought about how would an agent interact with more than one person. And I think, again, that's just the usual human thinking, right? Because what we're thinking is, oh, this thing's quite capable. If I throw it in a room with a bunch of other people, it will be fine. Why wouldn't it? Because humans generally are, you know. And then you suddenly realize, like, you know, some of these issues you've discussed, they're used to dealing with one person, having multiple personalities. How does that affect it, et cetera, et cetera? And it's just really interesting that we hadn't anticipated that, and now trying it, going, actually, you know, there's definitely room for improvement here. So, you know, that, apart from anything else, you know, that is definitely going to drive some innovation, because people want these things in an office environment, in a company environment, and companies are groups of people forming teams to make things happen. So you're going to need them interacting with teams, and that feels like that's going to be a prize for somebody, probably Microsoft or Google, but there we go.
Yeah, it's probably going to become the default or the most common use case, because if you think about, like, you know, I've got ChatGPT on my phone, I'm going to ask it about something, you know, it's Google search on steroids, right? Whereas the multi-user group use case is a very different beast, right? And involves quite a lot more cognitive complexity that humans handle out of the box. Not that humans come from a box, maybe some do, but it's, you know, it's a different way of viewing the world, and it's the more useful one, because, you know, where's the value that, you know, agents bring? Well, it's not knowledge, it's definitely productivity. And if you're in a corporate workspace, your productivity is always tied to other people, like always. So the idea that we've all got our own individual agents, and those agents don't ever talk to anyone else or talk to other agents is fanciful. And it's just a bit, I feel like we're in a transitionary state, and what comes out the other side might not be agents at all, right? It might be something a lot more ambient and background, right? Which is perhaps the way to think about this, that, you know, we it's like, right, you want a robot bar person that at the moment you kind of need to build a humanoid robot to do that job, because bars are organized around the human form, right? Whereas actually, if you see real, there exists real robot bartenders, and they exist in a robot bar, right? And they don't resemble humans. They're just like factory things.
Yeah,
right?
Arms.
Arms and stuff. And it's quite impressive. Why can't I have that in my local pub? Well, because you have to rebuild the pub, right? So I think we're in a situation where we have to think about things in a human-shaped way. But my intuition tells me that feels like a transitionary state. And because these things will never get out of their sycophancy trap or their lack of attention trap, and the models themselves aren't going to get much better, that the harnesses will probably start to evolve to make the models themselves less prominent, and the actions and the outcomes of the models to be a bit more ambient, which is sort of what you see with note-taking bots and stuff.
Yeah, that's very true. Although my mind's still on that completely personless bar and, you know, like one of the arms throwing a towel over its shoulder as it leans forward and listens to you tell you its problems, you know.
Yeah, well, we need the whole virtual cheers, don't we?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Some sort of, I've got some sort of film noir 1930s, you know, Philip Marlowe thing going on in my head. Yeah.
that would be good. That would be a step up, wouldn't it? Because most bar people couldn't give less of a crap these days. They're just kind of serve you your beer and move along. Right. On that cheerful note, go and get yourself some ice water, and brave the heat. And we will talk again soon. No idea about what. Maybe more Open Claw, maybe something different for a change.
Indeed. Well, enjoy it, and we'll speak again soon. Thanks, everyone.
Cheers. Bye.
The Confusion Matrix.